In September, the Trump administration made a series of statements related to autism, including linking the condition to acetaminophen use in pregnancy. Along with being scientifically dubious, the claims reflected a misunderstanding of rising reported autism prevalence in the United States over the past several decades. I'm Stephen Morrissey, managing editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, and I'm talking with Tara Eicher, a postdoctoral research fellow in the Department of Biostatistics at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Dr. Eicher has co-authored a perspective article about claims of an autism epidemic. Dr. Eicher, what actions did the Trump administration take as part of the September announcement related to autism?
So as part of the announcement, the Trump administration made claims, first of all, that autism is an epidemic and that this epidemic is linked to vaccines as well as being linked to Tylenol. So I'm essentially here to challenge these claims, including the claim that autism is an epidemic at all, as well as the claims that vaccine and Tylenol have anything to do with the rising cases of autism.
In fact, you say in your perspective article that the best available evidence suggests that the apparent increase in autism rates is predominantly attributable to shifting diagnostic practices. So how has the diagnosis changed in recent years?
If we look back at the history of autism diagnoses, Leo Kanner is often credited as first describing autism back in 1943, and he had a very narrow criterion that he used for diagnosing people with autism. He considered autism to be a very rare condition. The statistic of 1 in 10,000 that's often quoted by the Trump administration as well as by other people goes back to his work. And if we look, though, at other contemporary research that was going on, Hans Asperger was conducting research also in the 1940s in Austria on what we now know as autism. And prior to that, Grunia Sukareva in the 1920s in Russia, she was also conducting research in the condition that we now recognize as autism as well. And these two researchers both characterized autism as having much broader manifestation and as being a more common condition. So I want to note that, you know, when we talk about the shift in diagnostic practices, that this is also something that is grounded in earlier work. So Kanner's work, though, heavily influenced earlier versions of the DSM. So the DSM-3 was released in 1980. And one of the requirements for autism diagnosis at this time was that a language delay be present. In the later release of the DSM, the next version, the DSM-4, two other conditions were also included. So these included Asperger syndrome, which was introduced by Lorna Wing, but it related back to Hans Asperger's work. And Asperger syndrome did not require a speech delay. So this opened up the diagnosis to more people. In addition, there was another condition called PDD-NOS, or Pervasive Developmental Disorder Not Otherwise Specified, that required that some of the criteria for autism be met, but not all of them. And so this also opened up diagnosis to more people. So then in the DSM-5, which was released in 2013, these other conditions, Asperger syndrome and PDD-NOS, were merged into a singular condition called autism spectrum disorder. And so what we have now in the DSM is something that provides a much more accurate and much more comprehensive view of what autism is. And it includes people who did not have a speech delay in early development, as well as people who did not meet the criteria for autism diagnosis, according to the DSM-3. So in addition to that, I would say that there's increased awareness of autism and increased understanding of autism in general. So historically, minorities and girls have required more severe impairment to be diagnosed with autism, but that's something that's beginning to change. In fact, if we look at a report released by the CDC in 2022, they found that autism was actually more common in minorities and children from low socioeconomic status backgrounds. And this was the first time that this had been found, essentially. So what that tells us is that children from these backgrounds, now their families have better access to diagnosis, access that they didn't have before. And so this is something that we can certainly attribute this in part to increased awareness, increased access to diagnosis.
Getting back for a moment to acetaminophen, what's known about the potential link between acetaminophen and autism and other possible environmental contributors?
So if we look at the claims that are made, that the administration made regarding the link between Tylenol and autism, this relates to a systematic review that was published, and they linked it to Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health One of the authors on that paper is now affiliated with Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, but was not actually when the paper was published. And what this paper essentially did was it looked at studies that have been conducted on autism and Tylenol, and it claimed that in a majority of the studies, there was some positive association between them. Now, I want to note that since then, there's been an umbrella review conducted, and this was conducted last year, but looked at not only this study, but also other systematic reviews that claimed that there was a link between Tylenol and autism. Many of them relied on the same primary studies. But what this umbrella review found was that all of these systematic reviews were quite poor quality. So they used a criterion called AmSTAR-2 to evaluate the credibility of these studies or the confidence of these studies. And they found that there were some systematic flaws with them. So these included things like justification for inclusion and exclusion of studies, as well as the way the data were synthesized, as well as sources of funding not being reported for the studies that they included. So they concluded that the reliability of these studies or the confidence of these studies was low to critically low for all systematic reviews that reported a link between Tylenol and autism. In addition to that, a more recent study also that was done in Stockholm, and this study was done on over 2 million children. So this was data that was taken from a registry. And they found that these effects, the association between Tylenol and autism, disappears if you correct for sibling exposures. And what this means is that you look at if a child was exposed to Tylenol during the mother's pregnancy, it also looks at whether that same exposure was present in the sibling and whether the sibling was later diagnosed with autism as well. And so what they're looking at here, what this allows us to do when we correct for the sibling data, it allows us to evaluate whether the link between Tylenol and autism is a causal one or whether there is some other genetic factor that's leading to both an increase in Tylenol usage during pregnancy and an increase in autism diagnosis or in the probability of autism diagnosis. And so essentially what they found, again, is that these effects disappear. And that tells us that there's actually some other cause, likely a genetic one, that basically it causes this apparent correlation between autism and Tylenol. And it's not yet known what exactly that other factor is, but just giving an example of what it could be. And again, this is just conjecture. It may be that some of the conditions or some of the gene variants, rather, that cause chronic pain that might increase a mother's use of Tylenol in pregnancy may also be linked to autism. And so in this case, you have a genetic factor that is contributing to both of these things.
You say in your article that autistic people and their families have put forward important critiques of the state of autism research. So even before these recent announcements, what had been the problems with the federal government's approach to autism?
Yes, that's an excellent question. And in fact, I gave a talk on November 14th at the National Human Genome Research Institute about this. So that this was for a forum that was held, and the title of this forum was "What Do Researchers Owe the Autistic Community They Study?" And so in this talk, I mentioned several of the concerns that autistic people and their families have voiced regarding the current state of autism research, as well as how we can better address those concerns moving forward. And one of the things that people often mention is there's a lot of focus on causal mechanisms of autism, whether that takes the form of looking at potential environmental factors in autism, as Secretary Kennedy wants to look more into, or looking at genetic factors associated with autism. And the problem is that these types of causal studies don't really have a direct impact on autistic people's quality of life. And so many people have given the criticism that they want to see more research into things like, first of all, services and supports. And this is something that is not my area of expertise, but I would refer listeners to research by my co-author, Dr. Ari Naaman, because he has done a lot of research in this area. But in addition to more research in services and supports, if we look at research that is going on in genomics as well as in environmental factors, a lot of people want to see more research into co-occurring conditions. So there are a lot of conditions that we know tend to co-occur with autism. These include things like epilepsy, sleep disorders, clinical depression. And we know very little about why these co-occur with autism, if there's a better way to treat these conditions in autistic people. And this is something that I think is important to look into more. Also, when we talk about well-being and quality of life, there are certain autistic traits that can really adversely affect people's quality of life. And one of these is self-injury. This is a very common problem for many autistic people. And little is known about why so many autistic people self-injure and what we can do to help mitigate that, to help improve people's lives. So these are some of the areas of research that I think we should be looking more into rather than putting so much focus into causality. Another critique that people have made concerns the stigma that has historically been very prevalent in medical research in autism. And this includes stigma both towards families and towards autistic people themselves. And the stigma towards families has taken the form of blaming families for their child's autism. For example, the refrigerator mother hypothesis that was proposed by Kanner and other researchers during his time, as well as when I talk about stigma towards autistic people themselves, this is oftentimes taken the form of autistic people being portrayed as broken, or autism being portrayed as something that robs a family of their child or that destroys families, similarly to what Secretary Kennedy said. So the stigma in the medical community is a huge topic within the autistic community, and it's something that advocacy efforts have really pushed back against. And I think that the medical community is starting to change the way that we talk about autism. But I also think that with this address given by the administration, it seems like a concerted effort to go back to increasing the stigma, both towards the autistic people and autistic children's families and autistic people's families. First of all, by blaming mothers, saying that it's essentially their fault because they took Tylenol and that they need to tough it out if they have a fever, but also with the rhetoric that was used. And in fact, I will say that, so two organizations, Autism Speaks and the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, issued a joint statement condemning many of the statements that were made by the administration during this address. And first of all, the scientific claims that they made, but also the stigmatizing language that was used. And that tells you how serious of a problem this is, because these two organizations, Autism Speaks and the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, almost never agree on anything, but they agreed on this.
So finally, and this goes back to what I think to what you were talking about a moment ago, you talk in your article about a culture of distrust between parents of autistic children and physicians. So where does that come from and what could be done to improve it?
This really kind of relates to the stigma that has pervaded medical research historically. And I think if you look back again at this sort of blaming of refrigerator mothers for causing autism, this is one of the reasons I think why this vaccine autism link myth just keeps perpetuating, because people don't want to think that they caused challenges that their child is facing. And so I think that this is the reason why many people, many parents have kind of turned to these alternative medicine practitioners in hopes that they will somehow be more understanding towards the families than clinicians have been. But oftentimes this is detrimental, because some of the treatments that are prescribed by these alternative medicine practitioners include things like chelation and treatment with chlorine dioxide, both of which can be fatal. So I do want to mention that. So in terms of, I think, parental distrust towards the medical community, I think it does relate back to this stigmatizing portrayal of the parents. I also think that in terms of autistic people themselves and the autistic community, a lot of people are concerned because, again, because of the stigma that has sort of pervaded medical research historically, people are worried about things like eugenics, and people are worried about how their data might be used and how the results of these studies might be used. And I think it's important as researchers that we listen both to what families have to say as well as what autistic people have to say, so that we can essentially, first of all, address what people's needs are, as well as addressing some of their concerns and getting back some of that trust.
Thank you, Dr. Eicher.